Last case this morning is...
Please the court. My name is Bill Lee, and together with my partner, Joe Mueller, I represent MoneyGram. In my time today, I'd like to address three issues, if time permits. Obviousness, the district court's claim interpretation, which construed the claim, is not limited to an order of steps, and the doctrine of equivalence. Let me turn first to the question of obviousness. As the briefing demonstrates, and I think there's no disagreement about this, the Western Union patents were embodied in a system called the yellow phone system, a commercial system. That system...
Apart from your common sense argument, which I've always observed has little to do with common sense, but did your expert explain why a person of skill in the art would find this obvious?
He did, Your Honor. In fact, he explained why once they, something like a keypad, which you see at CVS, or a gas station, came into being. In fact, it was in being, as the specification discloses in column 4. Just using that additional technology to replace the fax machine with a keypad was something that would have been obvious to an ordinary skill of the art, and he said would have yielded predictable results. There was no, this is an unusual case, Your Honor, in the sense that there's no opposing expert testimony. The record is uncontradicted. He's the only one who testified on this issue. So I think going to that portion of the obviousness standard, what you have before you is a record that demonstrates that the specification itself says this keypad was something that existed in the prior art and was readily available. You have expert testimony without contradiction saying, well, if you want to substitute the keypad for the fax machine, it would have been obvious to one of ordinary skill in the art, and the results would have been predictable and no rebuttal. And in that circumstance, we would suggest that it makes out a case of obviousness as a matter of law. I think, Your Honor, this is a case in which, if I could say these three things about the obviousness issue.
You know where I'm a little concerned here, Mr. Lee, and that is common sense is this broad category, and of course it's been thrown at us by KSR, but doesn't there have to be a link between what one of skill in the art would really understand and this broad category of something called common sense?
Your Honor, I would say these two things.
Sure.
KSR has given us that concept, but this court has applied the common sense concept in several cases. Just 2 weeks ago or a week ago, in the Master Lock case, it dealt with the common sense to one of ordinary skill in the art in that field. In Muni Auction, the court dealt with common sense, and it was actually quite analogous in the sense that what was in the prior art...
Do we need I'm asking if we need a link. Do we need some indication of why one of skill in the art would have considered this common sense?
I think, Your Honor, not to revisit the KSR debate, we certainly don't need the strict teaching suggestion motivation. But the tie that...
Strict. See, I've always struggled with that. There's nothing strict about a suggestion, a mere motivation. These are broad, sweeping terms. And yet, what we do need is some evidence at the time of invention that would have said one of skill in the art would have had an amorphous motivation and completely amorphous suggestion. We do need that, don't we?
Yeah, and Your Honor, it's at A21947.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for.
I think that I intentionally didn't want to wade again into the debate about how strict it is, but to the extent that the law requires that there be a tie, however Your Honor characterizes it, whether it's common sense, whether it's some version of the teaching and suggestion or motivation, MoneyGram called an expert, and the expert said the keypad was something that existed in the prior art. If you wanted to substitute the keypad for the fax machine, it would have been obvious.
Mr. Lee, aren't you saying that this kind of money transmittal system existed in the OV system?
Yes.
And every kind of manual system these days is going electronic, And to do so, you need the internet, you need some sort of keypad, and if you're dealing with money, you need a code. I mean, why? Isn't that your position?
That is our position, Your Honor, and I think in this case it's even narrower than that.
And isn't that what KSR said? They raised the bar. They didn't redefine the standards, but they sort of raised the bar for
I think KSR did raise the bar in terms of what's required to demonstrate obviousness. And in this particular case, it's even narrower, I would suggest. I think what Your Honor has described is correct. But in this particular case, two things. And the briefing has narrowed the distinctions between the undisputed prior art and the claimed invention to just two aspects, the code and the keypad. If I take them in order, the code, which Your Honor mentioned, the patent says at column 2, line 45, a code could be a name. Well, in the Orlandi Veluti system, if I'm the one who called it in, I walk up to the agent and I give them my name. The patent says that's the code. The only difference in that circumstance is that in Orlandi Veluti, I get a fax sheet with my name, my transaction, the recipient, and a clave, a code or a key. And in the yellow phone system, it comes up electronically. The only difference. The only other difference they cite is
But it comes up at a different time in the transaction, right? You get the code during the transaction as opposed to the end.
Well, you get the code during the transaction, Your Honor.
And that's different.
It's different than the ordinary use. Now, the clave or a key, I think two different points, Your Honor. If I focus on the clave or key that comes with the fax transmission, Your Honor is correct. The ordinary use is not to go get your fax. You use your name to get the fax. But you can use it to go back and change the information, clarify the information before it's completed. We didn't claim anticipation for the reason that Your Honor has just described. But the question is, really, if you have a fax that has something called a clave for a formless transaction that's a key, right, is it really a novel and non-obvious step worthy of a patent to take that and say, okay, use it during the transaction? And I think that's why it's an obviousness question rather than
And in addition to which, using codes during these kinds of sales transactions has been out there forever, right? I mean, is this any different than, you know, having gone 50 years to a bakery and getting a number so that for privacy reasons and others?
This is no different than when I go to the meat counter store and I pull number 5 out, and I'm number 5 and I wait for them to call number 5. It's the same. And in fact, that's why their broad description of what a code could be, a name, a number, makes the invention obvious. This really is a circumstance in which, if we set aside the clave, let me assume just for a second that our fact sheet didn't even have that clave or key, this still would be obvious because the patent says at column 2, my name can be my code. And the difference literally here is between walking up with my name and getting a fax transmission sheet, with or without.
Your name wouldn't be a good code. There are a lot of Lees.
There are hopefully not a lot making money transfers.
Let me ask you about infringement. The difference between one computer and two and one database and two, when you're dealing with equivalents, that's not significant, is there?
Well,
is
it? Your Honor, I think this is what I would say to this. I think the question of equivalents has to be viewed in the context of what has the inventors have convinced the patent office is a significant step forward. And if you take the Orlandi Veluti system, which is in part described in column 1, but without all the details of the Orlandi Veluti system, and say, well, what are the inventive steps forward? They are at best, we say they're obvious, but they're at best very small steps. If they are sufficient to render the patent novel and not obvious, then the question of two databases versus one, the question of a first computer versus more than one, are equally significant. And I think the doctrine of equivalence issue has to be viewed, measured against the same perspective and the same prism as the obviousness question. And I think the key, one of the key non-infringement questions is the question of the order of steps. And we've suggested to the panel that on the obviousness question, UniAuction, Leapfrog, master lock are actually pretty close to analogous and right on. On the question of the order of steps, we suggest that these steps and e-pass are virtually identical. And the order of steps here has two aspects that we suggest require our claim construction for the steps to be performed in the order in which they're delineated. First is just the antecedent basis. When it refers first to the transaction details, it's just the transaction details, then they become the transaction details. The same as to the code. It becomes code and the code. But there's more. The tense, the steps actually have tenses in them, and the tense indicates that the prior step has been performed. So the second step refers to the transaction details, described as transaction details in step one, provided by the sender. So it's a question not only of antecedent basis, it's also a question of tense. And if we compare these steps...
But besides that, is there a necessity? Are you arguing that there's a necessity that you couldn't go to, you couldn't do perform step four until step three had been performed?
Not as described in these claims. Not as described in these claims, Your Honor, because it has the transaction details having been provided. Then after they're provided, they're stored. After they're stored, a code's provided. After the code's provided, you store that. Then you send the code over, as Your Honor indicated. So I don't think there's any real dispute that as read, plain meaning, that is what the claims would communicate. The only real dispute between us is whether there's one embodiment that might indicate out-of-order steps. And the answer is that's true. Figure 4 has out-of-order steps. It's an access card embodiment. It simply is not covered by the claim terms that they eventually obtain from the Patent Office. But this isn't a circumstance, as the briefing suggests, where there's not a disclosed embodiment that is covered. Figure 2 is exactly covered by this claim. Figure 2 describes these steps in their precise order. And if you compare Figure 2 to the claims, they're performed in a specific order. They're done so for reason, and that reason supports the claim interpretation that we urge consistently before the special master at claim construction and in our Rule 50 motions. And I'll reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Scipione.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Isn't Mr. Lee right? There seems to be an order to these steps.
There is an order, and but it's not required. As discussed below and as the district court found, it's clear that some of the steps need not be performed in order. This is different than the EZ-PASS case where we can see clearly there was a sequence and a requirement. Clearly, if you look at the language of these claims, at least two of these, flat out, don't need to be in order. Determining a collect amount. In fact, determining a collect amount by both parties, our embodiment and their embodiment as well, has determining a collect amount up front. When you speak to the customer service representative, a collect amount is given and it's determined.
But you can't store a code until you've established it.
No, in fact, the embodiment of the invention exactly shows where a code can be on a card before the transaction takes place. The inventor specifically contemplated that a code could be determined before the start of the transaction. So if you look at the Alteris case, which is the case both parties are relying on, to determine whether or not this is the type of invention where the inventors contemplate that it must be in this order, you go to two places. One is to the claims, and the claims clearly include determining a collect amount and a code, both of which do not have to be in that order, number one. Number two, these claims actually specifically do provide an order in one of the steps.
But Western Union's expert specifically told the jury there's no sequence to the elements.
He said there's no sequence except as to one step. There's a sequence with respect to after the code has been established. It has to have a code before you can provide the code. And the point is there, if you look at the Alteris case again, the specific language of the claims call out when they want to put an order, they said before you can do the transaction, you have the code established, and then you provide the code at the fulfillment stage. And the way to think about this is the claims are set up, and it was agreed by the parties and the experts. There's a staging step and a fulfillment step. And clearly before you get to the fulfillment step, you have to have a code. And the language of the specification for the claims clearly provides that.
Why isn't the invention obvious in moving from a manual system to an electronic system? And what's been added to it is is whether we call it common sense or prior art. It's clearly what one would do.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, the record, this would be one of the most outlier cases in this court's history where we look at this record. The parties in this case are direct competitors. They both do money transfer. We're talking about not single transactions. We've got to keep in mind, we're talking about billions of dollars. This invention has transferred billions of dollars. It's a complex system involving transfer of money.
But didn't Western Union transfer enormous sums of money before? I mean, they've been around forever.
They have, since 1851, in fact. But in this particular case, they were looking for a solution to the problem of moving into another market, specifically the convenience store market, where you can't have people standing around filling out forms. And the record is absolutely clear. The inventor here, Ernie Stoutenberg, testified. When they say there was uncontroverted evidence of obviousness, the inventor said, we looked at OV. Western Union owned OV at the time of this invention. They actually owned it. They looked specifically at it and said it was inadequate. We had testimony given by the inventor.
Right, okay. It's inadequate, and they want to update it, and they want to do certain things with it to make it correspond to other developments.
Right.
And they do it. I mean, that's not an answer to why it wouldn't have been obvious. There were no unexpected results here, right? By doing what they did, the result of their having done that was completely predictable.
Well, to look at it in context, not only Western Union, look, the results were predictable in the sense they got what they set out to achieve, but whether they could do this in a mass scale, whether this invention could work for its intended purpose, was something that other people had looked at. Not only Western Union, this MoneyGram actually looked at this invention, OV, in the time period in question, and said it was slow and didn't have all the functionality it needed. They actually hired a consultant, spent $240,000 to come up with a solution, even though OV was right in front of them. In this particular case...
Okay, well, you may be smarter than they are, but that doesn't make the invention non-obvious.
Well, if the court's going to look at it in the context of the one ordinary skill in the art, what better place to look than at the time of the invention, when both parties, who are one and two in the field, look specifically at this invention, the OV, the disclosure of OV, and say it is inaccurate. It doesn't have the security, the speed, the reliability, the accuracy. And the inventors here did that. They looked at it as well. They hired a consultant. And we came up with a new solution. The solution
but once
about.
You enter the electronic world, isn't all of this accuracy and automaticity and reliability suddenly a given?
Well, it's not a given.
Numbers on a keyboard, press enter, boom.
Well,
why isn't that just kind of a given once you have the electronic transfer capability?
Well, the electronic transfer capability existed well before this. This is 1998. There are 50 years of electronic transfer. MoneyGram's been sending money electronically since 1851. The electronic part
has
been around
forever.
So what
is it that you did that was novel?
What they did was novel was to look at a system and look at a system where you could create a code, connect it to a transaction, and provide that to the sender, where the sender then can have that confidentially and then provide it to an agent, and that transaction can be tracked. You have
that's been out there for years, right? I mean, that's just a variation standing in a meat line or a bakery line or carryout line and getting a number and then them calling your number.
First of all, there's no evidence of that in the record. The only evidence was OV. So the record shows OV was what they're looking at. And OV does not involve using a code. In fact, they had a fax machine. And as you've pointed out, Your Honor, that fax machine...
Well, you didn't invent using the code. You invented applying that task, which is out there, to this particular circumstance, right?
The invention is all the steps of the claim. It's a method claim. One of the things that's going on here is using a code in a particular method to get a result. In this case, having a transfer of money that has rife with problems in terms of security, privacy, reliability, and accuracy, and associating the transaction with a code, providing it to a sender. OV didn't do that. We're talking about OV now. That's the evidence of record. And OV didn't provide the sender with the code. There was a code in the computer, but it wasn't driving the transaction.
Well, we're not looking at anticipation. We're looking at obviousness. So we're not confined to just OV, right?
Certainly, but the record they presented, we have to look at the evidence they presented, was OV, and then later they've added this issue of, oh, gee, a code was obvious, which is not something they've argued below. It's a new argument they're making on appeal. They did not argue code before.
One thing you haven't mentioned is that you're defending a jury verdict.
Yes, sir.
And while obviousness is a question of law, how much deference, if any, do we owe the jury on this question of law?
I think substantial deference on the underlying facts, because again, the jury, we are called upon, the court is called upon in evaluating these questions, not to come in with hindsight and say, oh, today it looks obvious to me. The standard, first of all, is one of ordinary skill in the art, one involved in these kinds of transactions. The jury heard evidence from those in the field at the time, including the inventor, one of the inventors, Ernie Stoutenberg, who talked about the fact that at the time we looked at OV and we saw it was inadequate.
Mr. Lee said you didn't present any evidence in opposition to their challenge.
No, we cross-examined their expert, and we already had Mr. Stoutenberg testify. We did not call him back. But in anticipation of what they were going to say, Mr. Stoutenberg testified at length about his experience in developing the invention, the steps that he took. We also had the opportunity to cross-examine their people with respect to this report that they got, the Cambridge advisor study that they had, which cost $240,000. MoneyGram was aware of OV at this time, but still commissioned a study.
Do we know that MoneyGram spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop the invention? That money could have been spent for a lot more than just developing the invention, right?
It's very interesting because at trial they argued exactly what you just said. They spent $240,000 to develop this Cambridge study, and it was an anticipation document, 400-page document. That issue did not get to the jury because it was bogus. And they've switched around on appeal now and arguing, oh, the $240,000 was about something else. They spent $240,000, this is what they argued below, to develop what was called a form-free transaction. And a phone-based transaction was in the document. And their expert testified, made a report and testified that this $240,000 that they spent, even though they knew about OV, was to come up with a form-based transaction. And they picked and choose from the document, this long document, to say...
So do we have to assume that the jury gave weight to your interpretation of that
absolutely
proceeding?
They heard testimony that said this phone-based transaction we created, even though OV was known, they spent $240,000 to do this. Now, they didn't get to decide this as anticipation because the court didn't allow them to pick and choose. In other words, the idea was there was disclosure of part of the invention in one place, a 400-page document, and then they went through the whole document, said this was all about coming up with a solution as an alternative to what OV was out there. But the point is, the jury heard all this testimony, Your Honor. They heard testimony from the inventor. They heard testimony from people on their side who were involved in the development. It is clear their attorneys looked at OV. When they did their opinions, they didn't say anything about anticipation or obviousness. When they did their opinions, they had seven opinions of counsel. They never raised it. When you want to talk about a record at the time, this court would do violence to the idea of ordinary skill at the art of the time. When you have inventors in the field, both parties, highly motivated to come to a solution. You talk about secondary considerations, let's jump into that. It wasn't mentioned, but one of the beefs they have in their brief is their own secondary considerations. Look at what happened here. We had documents, testimony given from their people, which basically deposition excerpts that were played for the jury. They needed to come up with a solution to get into this field. They needed to have a form-free system, because what you have before this, even with OV, is you have people loitering around at stores. You have people filling out forms, standing in line, waiting. You can't have that at a convenience store. You have to find a way to move people in and out. Even under the OV system, which had the phone in at the beginning, you still have people standing around waiting for transactions. You have faxes that arrive, which could be for thousands of dollars, sitting there. They could sit there for a week, curled up faxes, waiting for someone to come and collect the money. This is the system they had. This is the system that we had. And both parties looked at this and said, this is inadequate. We have to find something different. They commissioned their study. We turned our inventors loose. We came up with our solution. The jury heard all of this. And they also heard that our system was tremendously successful. We've transferred billions of dollars a year using this system. The revenue for this system has been, over a period of time, $50 million a year, literally thousands, hundreds of thousands of transactions using the system. And we heard testimony from Dave Owen, one of the witnesses, who said this system was what we needed to get into this niche.
In the OV system, a fax was automatically sent. There was no need to wait around for weeks, was there?
But the fax could sit around for weeks. Either end of the transaction was flawed. The fax could sit around. So you could get there too soon, and you could stand around and wait for someone to call your name, or the fax would come and you'd wait. There wasn't a synchronization of the two. So from a security and reliability and privacy point of view, we actually heard Mr. Stoutenberg testify that he heard this, that people would come and you have your name called. Mr. Scipiora, your fax is here. You're now announcing to the store that your money has arrived. That was unacceptable from a business point of view, but that's literally how OV worked, and we had testimony from the jury to hear that. These people all heard this, looked at it at the time, and decided we have to do something different. For us to sit here today, oh gee, I could pull a ticket from a meat market. You're transferring billions of dollars. You have bright, talented people, a multi-billion dollar company here and a billion dollar company here, one and two in the market, looking at the same problem at the same time. For these,
but isn't that inherent in the movement from old manual systems to electronic systems? It happens like that. Everything happens so fast now, and you didn't invent that.
That is in the category, Your Honor, of rank hindsight. There was electronic commerce well before 1998. We all know that. There were computers. There were terminals. All of the functionality was out there. Their argument, what they're trying to do, as you've heard in their arguments, and they've raised these for the first time in appeal. We haven't even talked about all the new issues they've raised in appeal. They're in our briefs. But, for example, in the code, they say, oh, gee, the code. They didn't argue that below. They're making that argument now. The point is that at that time, no one was doing that. Only OV actually had the phone in. They were the only one. And it wasn't until we came up with the idea of putting this all together in this way that we mechanized it. It wasn't like it wasn't there. An important distinction needs to be made when you look at this record. They want to argue from the point of view of almost apparatus claims. Oh, gee, you could swap a fax machine for electronic transaction fulfillment device. Aren't they the same? Well, first of all, that's wrong. It's clearly not. There's more than a keypad in this electronic transaction fulfillment device. They're the front end of a computer. They gather the data. They get the collect amount. They communicate back to a computer. They're much more functionality. But that's the wrong point of view. These are method claims. These are not apparatus claims. The idea that you could switch apparatuses is not the issue. The issue is a code-driven transaction that has this total functionality with security at both ends, which was not available. And their characterization, and Mr. Lee had to admit, we've had this red herring they've run around saying, oh, gee, the code was available. He's admitted, to his credit, that the code was not part of OV. There was some testimony of aberrationally that it was conceivable that there could be a case where the code might be available, but the function of the system, and there's no evidence that ever did happen. It was just a hypothetical as opposed to Mr. Stoutenberg. The evidence is, and the record shows here, when the transaction is conducted under OV, there is a code, it's in the computer, but it's not provided, it doesn't drive the transaction. The claims of this patent say the code is provided for the sender for use during the send transaction. That is not in the prior art. And by the way, OV is in the patent. It was disclosed to the patent office. I omitted to mention that earlier. Column 1 of the patent, OV is not specifically referenced, but it is there, it is described. In fact, they raised an inequitable conduct issue saying we didn't mention OV by name because the inventors listed a number of different structures that were possible. OV was provided to the patent office, accurately described, not contested, accurately described. The patent office looked at it and patented over. So when one talks about hindsight, when we have inventors, we have two big companies, we have lawyers looked at for opinion work, we have the patent office, all of whom at that time were looking at that, all of whom didn't see this, it truly is rank hindsight now to come in and say this is an obvious invention.
Thank you, Mr. Sapiora.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lee, you have 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 4 quick points. On the order of steps, EPAS says, and the holding is, if the language of, and I quote, most of the steps requires an order, then the claim does. Step 2 here requires an order, both because of the antecedent basis and because of its tense. That is the step that we wouldn't infringe if performed in order. And so the other arguments made about the 6th and 7th really don't determine the result. The first 5 steps do, and you have to tell us that's the right result. Second point, every improvement is not an invention. If we would, this court would have even more work than it has already.
It may be an invention, but it may not be a patentable invention.
It may not be a patentable invention, and it may well be an improvement. And the fact that two competitors get into a market, to a space, and try to improve upon something doesn't make for a patentable invention. Third point, if there is an invention here that addresses all of what Western Union says are the problems, it's the formless transfer. It's a formless transfer to address folks coming into a store who may or may not be able to fill out the form correctly, who may or may not have English as their first language. That is indisputably something that they did not do. The only thing that's added to this is a code and an electronic fulfillment device, which is a keypad, something that they indisputably did not invent. It's just an addition of well-known technology to someone else's invention to make a small improvement. Last point. On the question, Judge Luria, of the jury verdict, this is actually a circumstance in which, if the court considers the inventor's testimony at A21094 to 21095, you will see that he in fact admits that every single element of claim one of the 203 patent is in the Orlandi validity system. This is a case in which no expert was called to testify on their behalf. And this is a case, to go back to Judge Rader's question about the tie, whatever the requirement is, right, was made only by our experts without rebuttal. In that circumstance, we suggest that this is precisely the reason that JML exists. No reasonable jury could find this to be non-obvious on those facts. This may be two competitors who have improved upon a system that was invented by another. It's not a patentable invention. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Concludes our work.